They were having a fairly good time with their feasting and everything. They're not living on the edge of existence. They're pretty well adapted.
That was Susan Greeney talking about life in the Neolithic period.
The Athenians were terrified of combat, just like modern troops. But what's interesting to me is that the vast majority of them not only fought, but fought extremely well.
And that was Jason Crowley on warfare in ancient Greece. And welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. See historyextra.com/subscribe for subscription deals. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire and Google Play. For details of our digital formats, including price, content and availability, head to historyextra.com/digital. A recent experiment by English Heritage to find out more about Neolithic building methods has culminated in the construction of three Neolithic-style huts at Old Sarum in Wiltshire. They've been built using archaeological evidence unearthed from nearby Durrington walls. We sent our section editor, Charlotte Hodgman, to the site while building was still in progress, to talk to some of the volunteers and the experts involved.
So I'm standing with Susan, who is Senior Properties Historian at English Heritage. We're inside one of the houses. Can you maybe just talk me through, you know, the structure of the house and what we're actually seeing?
Okay, so we're standing in one of the largest and best preserved houses that was excavated. And these houses were excavated in 2006 and 7 at Durrington Walls, which is a site about 2 miles from Stonehenge. Mm-hmm. And when they excavated, what they found was small square structures with rounded corners, about 5 metres by about 5 metres. And that's what we're stood in a recreation of now.
Okay.
And the archaeologists found chalk beaten floors in the centre with a hearth.
Yeah.
They found evidence for possible furniture or beds, and they found the stake holes where the walls had been stood. So what we've done is replicate that by building the walls in using the stake holes in exactly the same positions where we found them.
Yeah.
And then above us, the volunteers are now beginning to thatch the roof structure. So this one's that a bit like an upside-down basket. It's kind of like a wattle structure, which goes right up, and we've put a ridge on this one.
Yeah.
Some of the other buildings outside, we've done a single apex. This one's got a ridge. And the volunteers are also now putting chalk cob onto the wattle fences. So this is a mixture of local chalk and straw and water. And this is going to dry and form a quite hard casing to the outside of the buildings.
Okay. And they're also thatching at the moment as well, aren't they? So
that's right, yeah, with wheat straw.
How long do you think it will take to kind of thatch the whole thing?
We should be finishing this one in the next week and a half, something like that. It won't take us very long. We've got to finish the thatching, we've got to finish the cob, and then we've got to lay the plaster floor. And this house in particular, we're also going to dress. We're going to put the furniture in and some of the objects and that sort of thing.
And what's made you want to do this? It was an amazing find, but you don't get many people who decide to recreate the houses.
That's true. So at the new Stonehenge Visitor Centre, we've got an external gallery.
Yeah.
And in that external gallery are going to be these three recreated houses.
Yeah.
But these are obviously part of the visitor attraction, so we couldn't do experimental archaeology on those houses because they've got to stand up to a million visitors a year.
Yeah.
And they've got to be part of the visitor experience. So what we want to do is test building the houses here first, test the different methods, test the different structures, and then when we build them at the visitor centre next year, they'll be really solid and good for the future.
Okay, brilliant. So will they be built by volunteers as well?
They will, yeah. They'll be built in the spring of 2014.
And are the houses being built as they would have been built, you know, in 2500 BC?
Pretty much. We've been using some prehistoric flint tools to cut the wattle, cut the hazel. We've been mixing and using prehistoric tools a bit. We have been using wheelbarrows. We haven't been very strict. We haven't said you cannot use a wheelbarrow, but we haven't been using, you know, chainsaws and that kind of thing. So, in essence, we are replicating the methods used.
Fantastic. And how did these houses differ to the ones that sort of were before this era?
Okay, so these houses date from the late Neolithic period, which is about 2,500 BC, about 4,500 years ago.
Yeah.
Before this time, in the early Neolithic, we do have some evidence for houses, rectangular, quite large rectangular houses. When farming first comes to Britain, we have large rectangular houses. And before that, we have a few structures, sort of wigwam-type structures that were Mesolithic in date.
Yeah.
But in essence, from prehistory, the evidence for houses is really, really rare.
Yeah.
And to have this evidence from Durrington is really unusual.
Yeah.
And the only other place really where there's such good evidence is at Scarabray and Orkney, where the houses are quite similar size and quite similar layout.
And do you think, I mean, Stonehenge is very near, you know, is it likely that these people who once, you know, would have lived in these houses in this type of area would have had anything to do with the building? So Henge, how did it fit into that story?
Okay, so Durrington's about 2 miles away from Stonehenge, and these houses we know have been radiocarbon dated to exactly the same time as the main stones, the sarsen stones, are being raised at Stonehenge. So it's quite likely that the people who are living in these houses, they may have been only living in the part of the year. They may have only been coming for a few months. Around the houses was evidence for feasting, pig bones, cattle bones, pottery, lots and lots of rubbish outside the houses. They were seemed to be doing quite a lot of midwinter feasting in particular. So it's quite possible that there were some kind of midwinter rituals which were being enacted. So either the people were using Stonehenge or they were building Stonehenge. They definitely had some connection to Stonehenge.
Yeah. And what sort of, have you encountered any problems during the experiment?
No, we've had quite a cold spring. So I think some of the volunteers have been particularly good and particularly cold at times.
Yeah.
So it just shows you the kind of, you know, what it's like to be living and working outside, really. Even at the time of year, which you might think would be quite nice.
And how would settlements like these have been arranged? I mean, how many people would have lived in a hut like this?
We don't really know because we haven't really got the evidence.
No.
But you can see it's quite a large space.
Yeah.
You can imagine a family or a small group of people living in here quite comfortably.
How big would you say it is?
It's about 5 metres by 5 metres.
Yeah.
If you've got a hearth in the middle here,
yeah,
lots of beds and furniture around the edge. A kind of hovel, is it? It's quite a nice space.
Yeah.
But the thing is, with the Stonehenge settlement at Durrington, we don't know whether it's a priestly class. Perhaps it's all men. Perhaps it's all women. Perhaps it's families. Perhaps it's everybody. We don't really know that. It doesn't seem to be typical everyday housing.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a mystery who exactly might have been living in these houses.
Yeah. One thing that does strike me is that once the thatch does go on, it's going to be quite dark in here.
Yeah, it will be.
There are no windows. How would the smoke and things like that have got out? So?
Okay, well, yeah, it would be quite dark. Obviously, you've got light from the doorways, and it's going to be interesting to see exactly how dark it is actually inside here. The hearth would have been in the centre of the room, and the smoke would just percolate up through the roof. The draw through from the doorway and up would just send the smoke up into the roof. We're actually going to be doing some tests for that in a few weeks' time. Once we finish the buildings, we're going to be lighting some fires and seeing what happens.
Yeah.
Seeing how smoky it gets in here, seeing what kind of wood burns quite well, seeing what happens to the smoke. But it should just percolate out through the thatch.
What would Neolithic England have looked like to the people who would have lived there? What would the environment have been like around them?
Okay, well, largely, around Stonehenge in particular, it's probably open grassland.
Yeah.
These people have got large herds of cattle and pigs, and they're moving with their cattle around, probably following sort of regular seasonal routes. The population wouldn't have been massive, would have been quite scattered. You might not have seen other, you might have lived with a group of people, but not necessarily seen other people. But at particular times of year, midwinter perhaps, midsummer, you might have all come together to celebrate, to feast, to exchange goods, to meet each other.
Mm.
And I think it would have been these people knew their natural environment inside out. They knew exactly where to get their materials. They knew exactly how to catch the right birds and animals, where to get plants from. They knew exactly what they were doing. And they were having a fairly good time with their feasting and everything. They're not living on the edge of existence. They're
so
pretty well adapted.
Quite a change from before. So they were farming and sort of cultivating land and
things
like that? Or?
It's difficult to know. The farming at this time, there's not so much evidence for cereals.
Okay.
There isn't any evidence, for example, for grinding stones, quern stones from this particular group of houses.
Yeah.
So it looks like they must be importing some of their, you know, grain, bread, that kind of thing. But farming is more to do with the domestic livestock, very important cattle and pigs, crop growing, probably in a small scale, but perhaps not so important.
Okay. And what will happen to these houses when they're finished? Are you going to leave them here? Or?
Yeah, they're going to be up until about the end of May, and we're going to have two open weekends, the two bank holiday weekends in May. People can come and have a look around and see what we've been doing. And then in about mid-June, we're going to be taking them down.
Oh, all that hard work.
They're not permanent structures. They're just experiments.
Oh dear, one of the volunteers is crying. Well, thank you very much. I'm talking to Nick, who is one of the volunteers at the site. Nick, what made you want to come and volunteer to do this project?
Well, for me, it's a fantastic learning opportunity. Mm. I take a lot of people to Stonehenge as part of my job. I'm a driver guide. I specialise in World Heritage. And I do a bit of World Heritage consultancy. This enables me to learn so much about the way people lived.
Yeah.
It was the most wonderful opportunity. How many opportunities do you get to influence the landscape of Stonehenge?
Yeah.
Not very many.
And what's been the kind of the most interesting part for you? Is it the actual building or, you know, learning about the history behind it all?
There's so many interesting dimensions. I think the first interesting bit was when we were working in the forest to collect the material. Each of these buildings takes 2,000 rods of hazel. The interesting thing, the link from the archaeology, is that the spacing between the stake holes is the same spacing that you would use if you were weaving 7-year-old hazel coppice. So those people who do that kind of thing today, making hurdles and so on, recognize that spacing. You need 7-year-old hazel. So we go into the forest. You learn that these places have been managed for hundreds, probably thousands of years. And we used flint axes, bronze axes, as well as modern tools.
Yeah.
So one of the most fantastic experiences is moving from a flint axe to a bronze axe, and that leap, that evolutionary leap, is just amazing. You wouldn't believe the increased in efficiency that you get from a bronze axe. They're as good as anything you'll get down the garden centre today, you know. And so there are all sorts of things we learned in the forest. I learned that the Neolithic was very smoky and muddy in January. And then here, weaving these things, creating the roofs, you know, there's just so much to explore and so much to learn. So for me, it's fantastic.
And you're looking quite mucky. What have you been up to this morning? What have you been doing?
I've been daubing.
Okay.
We've spent much of the last sort of 5 or 6 weeks wattling, which is weaving the sticks in between the vertical stakes. So we're now effectively putting the plaster on the walls. So wattle and daub is the technique.
Is that inside and outside?
Inside and outside, yes. And the trick is to try and get the daub to kind of join in the middle, so it's keyed on both sides. So we'll end up with something that looks vaguely like a plastered wall. It won't be quite as smooth as what we're used to these days. But this technique must go back thousands and thousands of years.
Looking around me, this the middle house looks like it's kind of progressing the most. Is this the one you've been working on the longest?
Probably, yes. I was involved in doing the roof of this. I was experimenting on this other more temporary structure, the one that doesn't have any stakehold
evidence. It's a bit like
evidence.
A teepee.
It looks like a teepee. I also made another version, which was more like a frame tent. And that would be being covered in skins. So nobody's quite sure what these things were.
Crucially, given the weather lately, once the daub's up and the wall's up inside, would that have been waterproof? Would that have been...
The key idea with these daubed walls is you have to keep the water off them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you have to keep the rain off them. Otherwise, they get washed away. And so much will depend on whether we've got the roof right. So they have these very large overhanging eaves, which should drop the water clear of the walls. As soon as you get water running down the walls, you're in trouble. So that's why they have these huge overhanging eaves.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, I'll let you get back to your work, but thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Claire. So what this structure here, which I described earlier to Nick, looks a bit like a teepee. How does this one differ to the other houses that are being built?
Well, the most important thing about this one is that the posts are not in the ground at all, because the evidence for this building was just a chalk floor with no stake holes in. So we've basically imagined, and this is actually the fifth version of this building that's has gone up, and it's going to be our final version.
So why is it your fifth version? Did the other ones not work out? Or?
They were similar,
but
slightly different.
Okay.
So inside here, the evidence was for a roughly rectangular chalk floor with a hearth in the middle.
Right.
So we're building around that.
Will you be putting a chalk floor down?
Yes, we will.
What stage does that come? Is that one of the last things to do?
I think it will be, yes. once the roof is on.
So how long would it take to kind of put this structure together from the start? Ooh. How long have you been working on it?
All these three buildings together, this is our sixth week.
Right, okay.
So, there's roughly about 20 people working every day.
Gosh.
Over 6 weeks.
Is that rain or shine as well?
Rain or shine. But of course, we are learning new skills. We've never done thatching before. We've never done daubing. We've never done weaving hazel. Yeah. So we've got to learn as we go along. And also tying in the beams. That ring beam up there is supported entirely by the willow lashings.
Right.
And we've got to learn how to tie those knots and make it safe.
Yes. So now I'm talking to Luke. And Luke, where are you from again, sorry?
I'm from the Ancient Technology Centre in Cranbourne, Dorset.
Okay, and you're sort of overseeing the volunteers and the structure of the buildings.
Yeah.
So how's it all going so far?
It's going very well. We're sort of 6 weeks into the project. The project started actually with 2 weeks of harvesting in a woodland in Dorset, where we took flint tools and tried to harvest all the materials we required. Which was pretty tough. The volunteers we were working with, great bunch of people, but very few people in the world have experience with flint tools and constructing Neolithic houses.
Like a niched skill.
Absolutely. So they've come a long way from sort of understanding raw materials and their best properties to constructing the three structures that you see in front of you.
Okay. And what have you learned from constructing these? I mean, at the beginning, did you have an idea of how they would look and how you'd start doing it?
The whole process started with looking at the original excavation plans and then drawing up sort of concepts and then building models.
Yeah.
But even so, what we've found is that things have changed as we've gone along, simply because materials work in certain ways, and it's only when you actually use them in life that you understand those properties. So.
Yeah.
It's going very well. We're definitely discovering some things. The shape of the walls, it creates quite a puzzle in some of the structures. They're kind of squarish buildings with rounded corners. And the rounded corners make huge sense when you're weaving in coppice materials. They're very strong.
Yeah.
But the straight sections in between are actually quite weak and seem to sort of flex a fair bit. So that's kind of led us onto a roofing method, which rather than putting in traditionally straight rafters, as you would in an Iron Age roundhouse, for example, we're actually putting in rafters that are locked into the wall and then bend to the point of the roof. And it creates a basket effect really.
Yeah.
It makes it very solid and stops those walls from spreading. So we're discovering lots.
So how do you know that what you're building is actually what they would have looked like?
It's the ultimate question. And in short, we don't. But
okay.
what we are discovering is a range of methods which are working and a range of methods which aren't. So what we hope to do at the end of this is get a list of methods and styles which we know work and then come to a decision on what actually is constructed at Stonehenge at the new visitor centre. So I suppose my personal angle on this really is I would like there to be three different roof shapes and three different thatching materials at the finished buildings, because I think it's important not to present the Neolithic as this is how it looked.
Yeah.
We don't know that from any sort of period of prehistory. But what we can do is present things that we know work using the right pollen evidence and the right materials.
I suppose like houses today, our houses look different to each other, so why would they?
Absolutely, and I mean, it's we're probably not looking at teams of house builders who go around like and sort of build a persimmon, a Neolithic persimmon complex. So there's always going to be that individual quality in each structure, and at the end of the day, we can't always look at sort of functional reasoning behind the way things look, because we're modern humans.
Yeah.
And there might be reasons for the way things look which make no sense to us in the modern world.
Yeah. So what's been your favourite bit of the whole project? The harvesting
was good fun. The final tree we felled was a 40 centimetre diameter pine tree, and it took about 3 hours and 11,477 blows with a flint axe. So that was quite interesting. It just, again, what it does is it highlights the fitness of these people and their sort of stamina.
Yeah.
But in terms for me, apart from the construction and the experiments that we've been doing, is working with a fantastic team of people. The weather has been atrocious for many weeks. But people keep turning up and keep putting in a huge amount of effort, and it's been really good.
And what do you think we can learn from this type of project?
I think I always find it fascinating trying to reconstruct very early buildings, but essentially the modern world, we've sort of fallen into many traps in the modern world in quite recent periods, and the traps are materials from Brazil and from Africa, and these buildings show quite clearly that you can gather materials from your local area, get a small group of people together, and produce really sustainably sound buildings which work. And that's kind of heartwarming in a,
they look fantastic,
in a fuzzy sort of
really
way.
Do.
Yeah.
Well done. Cool. Thank you very much for that. Cheers.
That was Charlotte Hodgman on location in Wiltshire. You can see images of the structures and the volunteers at work at historyextra.com/Neolithic. Before our next interview, I'd like to quickly mention that tickets are on sale for our History Weekend Festival. It's taking place in the historic Wiltshire town of Malmesbury from the 25th to the 27th of October, and will include talks from some of Britain's leading historians, including Max Hastings, Michael Wood, Dan Snow, Susanna Lipscomb, Dominic Sambrook and Kate Williams. For the full lineup and ticket information, visit historyweekend.com. Hand-to-hand fighting in ancient Greece could be a bloody affair, and warriors witnessed some of the most ferocious battles known to military history, none more so than those fought by Athenian citizen soldiers known as hoplites. Charlotte Hodgman caught up with Dr. Jason Crowley from Manchester Metropolitan University to discuss what motivated these men to fight and the Athenian social system that moulded them.
Firstly, who or what were the hoplites?
Well, a hoplite is a specific type of warrior that we find in classical Greece. He was specifically a heavy infantryman and a close combat specialist. That is to say, he doesn't rely on missile weapons like bows or slings. He engages his enemies at close range with a stabbing weapon, typically a spear. And what he does on the battlefield is exactly the same role as modern infantrymen, our modern infantrymen in the British Army. It's their job to close with and kill the enemy. And that's exactly what the hoplite did. He was tasked with closing with and killing other enemy hoplites, other heavy infantrymen. The name hoplite comes from the Greek word for military kit, hopla. So the hoplite is quite literally the guy with the gear. He's the weaponized man. And this is in distinction to gumnertes, people who were naked on the battlefield, people who literally didn't have armor or proper weapons. So the hoplite from hopla is the guy with the gear. And there are four elements to this gear: a primary and secondary means of offense, and a primary and secondary means of defense. Mm-hmm. So the first one, primary means of offense, is a long thrusting spear with a leaf-shaped blade. And he uses this to stab savagely at his enemies, aiming for face, neck, chest. And this weapon appears to have been, if we can trust the ancient sources, quite delicate. And in furious combat, the spear often breaks. So he needs a secondary weapon. And this secondary weapon is a short slashing sword. And we have depictions of hoplites using their swords on pottery. And if they're any guide, then he uses his sword like a man uses an axe to chop wood without any finesse or style, just slashing vertically at his enemy. He has, as I say, two means of defense. The first primary means of defense is a large round shield called an aspis. And this is quite massive. It's 3 feet in diameter. And it has a curious double grip. One central band located in the center of the shield is where the hoplite puts his forearm. So the forearm goes through the central grip, and then he grips a strap at the leading edge of the shield. So it gives him a very strong grip on a really massive shield. And this makes him, in combat, rather a hard man to kill.
It must be pretty heavy, I'd imagine, as well.
Yes, it's a massive weight. And we'll see later on what effect this has on hoplite tactics. Now, because hoplites provide their own kit, If a hoplite was rich enough, he might have some metallic body armour as a secondary means of defence, a metallic breastplate, a metallic helmet. But there were hoplites of varying social classes, and ordinary or more ordinary men would primarily use, if they had body armour at all, either fabric body armour or leather body armour. And modern reconstructions have demonstrated that this is pretty effective, sometimes even more effective than metallic body armour. And if you think about it, Greece is a pretty hot place. Battles are fought usually in the summer months, and wearing a metal skin doesn't seem to be such a good idea. You can't bend down when you're wearing metal armour, and it gets very hot. So it seems metallic armour is a status symbol rather than something that's effective primarily on the battlefield.
And how were they trained?
Training is a very vexed subject. We have moved on really from a previous generation of scholars who fought in the Second World War or served in the National Service. And these guys looked at the hoplites. They saw they could form up in quite massive formations, sometimes 10,000 men strong. And they thought it utterly inconceivable that hoplites would have no training whatsoever. And so they looked around for evidence of training, and they looked specifically at the Spartans. And the Spartans, of course, field the finest hoplites in classical Greece. And the Spartans start military training. They're taken from the family home at the age of 7 and educated by the state to be the best warriors they can be. So a previous generation of scholars, based on their own experience in the army and based on what they see at Sparta, simply can't imagine a hoplite wasn't trained. Now, they look for evidence of training, and they don't find any direct evidence of training. But what they do find is that the Greeks loved a particular style of dance called the Pyrrhic, which was done in armour. It's a warrior's dance. And so previous scholars think, well, Greek hoplites need to be trained. This is the only militarised group activity we can find. So this must be the Greeks' version of basic training. And there are two reasons why I think this is quite simply wrong. Firstly, the Pyrrhic dance consists of a series of moves which include leaps and feints and dodges. And no doubt this was lovely to watch, but it makes no sense in the hoplite's tactical formation. And this is a close order formation. It's based on files of 8 men, and files line up side by side to produce a formation based on usually 8 ranks. And it's close order, that is, the men are close together. So there's simply no room to be leaping about and feinting. And the second is, if you think about it, hoplites don't really need an awful lot of training. The whole tactical formation is based on the file, that is, men one behind the next. And since all their formations are based on the file, all a hoplite needs to know is how to follow the man to his immediate front. And I don't think you need a great deal of tactical training to learn that skill. So my own view is that outside of Sparta, Greek hoplites receive either very, very little, so little that it's not detectable in the evidence, or no training whatsoever. And my view is no training whatsoever.
So these were just ordinary men?
These were indeed ordinary men. This, the Athenian hoplite phalanx, which is what I'm primarily interested in, was a citizen militia. So ordinary men, without formal training, performing what is essentially a civic duty to fight on behalf of their city-state.
So they didn't actually want to fight then, unlike the Spartans, like you say, who were trained from a young age.
Indeed, the Spartans are socially conditioned to fight. The Athenians, quite interestingly, do they want to fight? Well, the answer to that question is both yes and no. The Athenians, lucky for them, enjoy a real democracy, a direct democracy. That is to say, they directly vote for the policies they themselves adopt. So if they want to go to war, and we know they go to war more years than they're at peace, they vote for it personally, and then they go and fight it. So having voted to go to war, you then go home, take your shield from over the fireplace where it hangs, and you go out and fight. So we know the Athenians fight an awful lot of wars, and since they vote for them, at the strategic level, then yes, they do actually want to fight. But at the tactical level, that is when voters become warriors, and when they face the enemy, then we start to hear very clearly in our evidence, obvious signs of fear. And we have lots of very, very good quality studies on modern soldiers demonstrate that engaging in combat is an intensely fearful activity. Now, after World War II, a man called Stufer led quite a large team of sociologists and psychologists, and they interviewed and conducted research on a vast number of American soldiers who returned following the end of the Second World War. One of the things this team catalogued was feelings of fear, but not only feelings of fear, but the physical manifestations of fear. So they catalogued, for instance, men who were afraid experienced chattering teeth. I mean, we know these feelings, some of them at least from our own lives, chattering teeth, shaking hands, trembling knees, a dry mouth, a pounding heart. And some men, not an inconsiderable number actually, suffered from loss of bowel and bladder control. Now, when we look at the ancient evidence, the catalogue of fear symptoms that Stufer and his team put together are there for us to see in the evidence. So, for instance, we see just before the Battle of Amphipolis in 422, the Spartan commander who was just about to attack a body of Athenian troops saw that the Athenians were visibly trembling. Aristophanes, a comic playwright from classical Athens, tells a joke about a rather pompous Athenian commander losing control of his bowels when he meets the enemy. And we see in surviving law court speeches, prosecutions for men who failed to turn up to fight, who threw away their shields and ran, people who demonstrated cowardice in the face of the enemy. So it's quite obvious that at the tactical level, the Athenians were terrified of combat, just like modern troops. But what's interesting to me is that the vast majority of them not only fought, but fought extremely well.
So once the Athenian state had decided to go to war, were they compelled to fight? Did they have to fight, or could they refuse?
That's an interesting question. That is a very interesting question. And the answer is yes and no. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. So the question is really, why do men fight once their state has indicated that they should? And I can say two things. I can rule out two possibilities for certain. Firstly, Athenian hoplites do not fight for money. They do get paid, but the pay is very, very modest, and the system of payment was so unreliable that men thought it was completely unwise to go to war without their own financial resources to buy rations and what have you, because the Athenian state doesn't supply food or arms or equipment. The man provides it for himself. So the money is unattractive. And if you think about it, paying a man to risk his life is a very poor way of motivating him, because most men would rather be alive and poor than dead and rich. So as a way to get soldiers to fight, payment is poor. Secondly, the Athenians don't fight because they're forced in the same way as the Russians did during the Second World War. The Athenians never develop a corps of NCOs, men in our army, like sergeants and corporals. And they have nothing akin to the Roman army's centurion, whose primary function was to ensure discipline. They have officers, if we were to put it rather anachronistically in modern terms, they have colonels and men of senior rank like that. But these men have no coercive powers, almost no coercive powers whatsoever. If they're faced with insubordination, they can fine an offender or they can send him home. And that's it. So the Athenians don't fight because they're bribed or forced. They fight primarily because they're under social pressure to do so. What the Athenians did, and the Athenians have this in common with other Greek states, is that they conceived of masculinity and manhood to be determined or contingent upon a man's bravery in combat. So if this is the primary determinant of masculinity, it doesn't matter whether a man is rich, whether he's good-looking, whether he's intellectually impressive. If he was a coward, he was socially worthless. So if he was to claim manhood, he had to acquit himself creditably in combat. And the way the Athenian army was mobilized ensured that he had his own community as his examiner. And what I mean by that is the Athenian army raises contingents of men from local communities called demes. In these local communities, men would live amongst their friends, they'd work together with their neighbours, they'd intermarry, some of them would be blood relatives. These were people who knew each other, who lived together, who worked together. They were friends, neighbours, relatives by blood and marriage. And these men fought together. So a small levy from each local community would go towards forming the larger Athenian army. So you've got to imagine the Athenian hoplite phalanxes, lots of these little groups of men who all know each other. Now, when the Athenian army meets the enemy, if one of these men loses his nerve, if he breaks, if he drops his shield, pushes past his friends and runs, he can't do so without being revealed to be a coward in front of all of his friends. And his cowardice endangers all of his friends. And so when they return to their local community, they're not going to keep knowledge of his cowardice secret. They're going to spread it round the local gossip network. And that's a big problem for our Athenian. Because Athens, or at least in the local communities of Athens, is a face-to-face community. And in a face-to-face community, a man's reputation counts for everything. And if his friends return from combat and tell everyone what a coward he is, he loses that reputation and becomes socially worthless. And in a society like Athenian society, that's a fate worse than death.
So it's better to fight even if you didn't want to, rather than come home and face that.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's very cleverly makes combat avoidance less palatable than death in combat. So you'd rather choose physical death than a long
social death.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not these people aren't forced, it's that there's a different kind of force operating upon them.
And you mentioned the hoplites were sort of ordinary men. Were they led by trained soldiers, or were these the officers that you mentioned, were they too just ordinary people?
And what we find is that these people are not trained. There is no formal training, but they are highly experienced. The Athenians had a wonderfully peculiar system of selecting their senior commanders by direct election. And you had to be of a certain age to be elected as a commander. And that meant that by the time you were eligible to hold a command position, you probably served 10 years in the ranks. So you were a seasoned combat veteran before you were even eligible to be elected as a commander. And if you think that's very different from our own system where men graduate from Sandhurst and they go on to command our soldiers very well in combat, but having typically never served as an enlisted man and with no experience before they're appointed to a combat commander's position. So the Athenians make sure that all their commanders are former rankers with extensive experience of combat. And when they elect them, They elect them on the basis of their capacity for command, their courage, their experience, their past record. And so the tendency is to keep re-electing men who do well. And so your commanders simply get better and more experienced, and their capacity for command grows and grows the more they're re-elected. So they're not trained, but these people are highly experienced and highly capable.
And I suppose the longer they've been fighting, the more respect they would have commanded from the people around them.
That's exactly right. I mean, because these people have no coercive powers, and they can't bribe their men to fight with offers of large wages, they only have two means of command, and that is essentially persuasion and personal example. So they have to explain to their men why it's imperative they should risk their lives on this occasion. So the men are persuaded, they feel it's the right thing to do, they agree to the obligation to fight, and then they lead by personal example. So not chateau generalship, commanding troops from 50 kilometres behind the front lines, but leading your men in combat by fighting in the front rank yourself. So you ask the men to fight, and then you lead them by fighting yourself. And what we see, I think it's very creditable, is lots of senior Athenian commanders die, even when their troops are victorious. So they pay the ultimate penalty for their position of authority. So military theorists have recognized that this is, of all the styles of battlefield leadership, this is by far the most effective in combat.
And you've mentioned already that the Athenians, there's evidence of fear when they went to battle.
Indeed.
How did they actually fare in battle, considering they were essentially amateur fighters?
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I ended up studying the Athenians, because I wondered when I started studying them how on earth they made the decision to plunge themselves into such a savage form of combat where you're stabbing people at the closest range while they're trying to stab you. It sounds utterly horrifying to me. But they perform extremely well in combat. So, for instance, it's Athenian hoplites, creditably aided by a few men from a tiny city-state called Plataea, who hammer the Persians at Marathon in 490. So the Athenians win the first round of the Persian Wars. And when the Persians come back and they face the Greeks in the climactic Battle of Plataea in 479 BC, again, it is the Athenian hoplites, not the professional Spartans, who do most of the hardest and bloodiest fighting. So it's no exaggeration really to say that of all the Greeks who contributed to victory in the Persian Wars, it's the Athenians who have the highest claim to credit. So they equip themselves extremely well against the Persians. And once the Persian Wars are over, the Greeks go back to the normal state of affairs, which is fighting amongst themselves. This is their pastime. A famous war follows the end of the Persian Wars called the Peloponnesian War. It lasts 27 years and it's fought primarily between Athens and her allies and Sparta and their allies. So the Athenians, the amateur Athenians, are up against the professional Spartans. And not only do the Athenians fight all over the Greek world, they fight in central Greece, they fight in the north, they fight in the Peloponnese itself, they fight on Sicily. Every time they fight, they demonstrate an unwavering willingness to plunge themselves into combat and fight to the best of their abilities. Now, the Spartans, you would expect, the only professional army in the Greek world at the time, should really have hammered the Athenians quite quickly, but it takes them 27 years, and they have to combine with another Greek superpower, Thebes, who also has a very, very impressive hoplite army. And then they have to ally again with Persia, the mighty Persian Empire. So it takes three ancient superpowers to take Athens and our amateur army down, and it takes them 27 years. So These are impressive troops, backed up by a very simple and elegant military system.
Yeah. And who would you rather fought in battle, the Spartans or the Athenians, do you think?
No, you're really pulling at my loyalties. I think the Spartans were undoubtedly better. So if my neck was on the line, I think I'd have to join the Spartans.
Yeah, I think me too.
My heart lies with the Athenians.
And how did Athenian attitudes to fighting reflect in their everyday lives, say, compared to that of Sparta?
I mean, that's another really interesting question. The whole social structure of Athens and Sparta is very different. The Spartan society is dedicated to producing the best hoplites in classical Greece. Xenophon tells us why Spartan hoplites are so impressive, and they can do things that other Greek hoplites can't. So, for instance, Spartan armies can perform outflanking maneuvers, they can perform fighting retreats, they can even countermarch to shift the front rank from one side of the phalanx to another to face an enemy that pops up in their rear. And the Spartans are unquestionably the toughest hoplites in Greece. So we see during a very famous battle called First Mantinea, which took place in 418 BC, the Spartan commander, the Spartan king, issued some very, very foolish orders right before the two armies joined. And this put the Spartan army into absolute chaos. But the Spartans didn't panic. They just carried on fighting, and they won the battle despite the disarray their army had fallen into, when other Greek troops would have panicked and run. So they can do tactically advanced things, perform fancy manoeuvres, and they don't panic and run. They're far tougher than other Greek troops. But the Spartans pay a very, very high price for this level of military proficiency. They essentially distort their entire society in order to produce such impressive troops. Spartan society is highly militarized. It's no exaggeration to say that it resembles a military camp. Spartan men were all full-time hoplites. They start their training at the age of 7 when they're taken from the family home. They live most of their lives in barracks, eating communal food in communal messes, eating the blandest, most boring food, because ostentation in either dress or consumption is repressed at Sparta. They all have to sing the same military songs. This sounds like the most boring and dreary life you could possibly imagine. And when you think about it, what the Spartans are able to do after this long period of training isn't really that impressive. They can conduct fancy manoeuvres, but these fancy manoeuvres would take a modern soldier weeks to learn, not years. And the Spartans trained for years and years and years. So we have to ask ourselves, if the Spartans aren't spending all their time learning tactics and engaging in tactical training, what do they learn? And the answer to that question is, they learn toughness and unthinking social conformity, the ideal virtues of a soldier, or at least the Spartans' version of the soldier. And although this made them impressive warriors, the Athenians and their society were very, very different. Their society used social values and the structure of their army to produce first-rate, although amateur troops, without the need for extensive social conditioning or expensively trained leaders. And yet Athenian troops were just as tough and they fight just as hard as the Spartans. But instead of living in a dreary society based on social conformity, they lived in a vibrant, chaotic society that was something rather special. Athenian society produced the most impressive men. So men that are still household names today, the playwrights Euripides, Sophocles, Aristophanes, the statesman Pericles, well-known philosophers like Plato and Socrates. These people still have an ongoing intellectual influence. Athenian society produces the most famous architecture, like the Parthenon, that continues to fascinate us. Most importantly, Athenian society produces the most incredible revolutionary system of government, namely direct democracy. And this gave all Athenians, regardless of their social status, the right to directly determine state policy. And it enabled Athens to become, during the classical period, the most powerful Greek city-state the Greek world had ever seen. So I betrayed myself by saying I would fight amongst the Spartans to save my own skin. But if I had to be reborn in classical Greece, I certainly wouldn't choose Sparta if I had the option of Athens.
That was Dr. Jason Crowley from Manchester Metropolitan University. Dr. Crowley is the author of The Psychology of the Athenian Hoplite, The Culture of Combat in Classical Athens, which is published by Cambridge University Press. And that's almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we'll do our best to read out some of your messages in future episodes. One listener who contacted us last week was Angie Smith, who lives in Fort Worth, Texas. She says, "I've listened to your podcast for the last 2 years. Now I subscribe to your magazine. Your podcast is intelligent, informative, and entertaining. It is the best podcast anywhere. Thanks for the hours of pleasure." Well, thanks for that, Angie, and your check is in the post. Please do keep your messages coming. We're also, of course, on Twitter @HistoryExtra and on Facebook.com/HistoryExtra. Next week, we'll be in London speaking to the winners of one of the most prestigious history book prizes. Do join us for that. The History Extra weekly podcast was recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.